This week on Your Western Context, new conservative leader Aaron O'Toole is a surprise to the media. Alberta's first black justice minister is overshadowed by economic woes, and the opioid crisis is spiraling out of control in BC. Also, we look at China's hostile takeover of Nortel. This is Western Context, episode 184, recorded Friday, August 28th, 2020. Plotting the Reckoning. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Western Context, returning to you at your regularly scheduled Sunday programming time. This week, we're not waiting for the results of a party leadership race that was delayed by a few hours, and you know, following up from that, we certainly have a lot of news to talk about this week on that and many other stories.
That's for sure. There's been a lot of news this week in the last week of August as we are showing up to you on your podcast device, and there's certainly lots in the news that's been talked about, but there's quite a few stories that have almost flown quite under the radar, and the media has not given them the attention that they deserve, and that is what we are here for.
That's right, and each and every week we've been doing this since January 2017. Our whole idea here behind Western Context is to provide a podcast to you, our listeners, that'll help you remove all the media bias and sensationalism that you see in the news each and every week, whether it's on TV or in the papers or online, especially social media. And in doing so, hopefully we'll provide all the information and context necessary to put you on the right side of the news. And we're going to pick up right where we left off last week, talking about the win that saw Aaron O'Toole become the newest leader of the Conservative Party of Canada.
Yes, that's right. And quite a few media outlets out there after last Sunday evening were scrambling to make articles about how the new leader won. And certainly that's what we have up there as our headline, How Aaron O'Toole Won. Well, let's go into it. Since Aaron O'Toole's big win late on Sunday evening in the conclusion of the Conservative Party of Canada's leadership race, the mainstream media has been stumbling over themselves to try and define who the relatively unknown new leader is and what terrible, terrible methods he benefited from to win. And we're going to go through all of those misconceptions in the coming minutes here. Now, O'Toole's victory has been debated over by the media, and many different theories have cropped up as to why he won. There's quite a few that said, oh, he won a handful of votes in Quebec that put him over the top. Others say that he tapped into social conservative voters. Another one said that he had strong second choice support amongst the other three candidates. Another said that he was just quite simply another safe choice. Another mentioned that he didn't disparage a large part of the party like Peter McKay did, or that he targeted Alberta, the CBC stronghold, early on in the campaign. And certainly these are many different reasons, and some or even all of them might have played a part in what happened on Sunday night. Now, Brian Platt of Nanton News argues that O'Toole emerged victorious thanks to two key factors, that he won Quebec and that he won the support of Leslie Lewis and Derek Sloan voters. He profiles the rural Quebec riding of Becansour-Nicolet Sorel, where O'Toole had just 33 votes, but Peter McKay had 19 votes, Lewis had one vote, and Sloan didn't receive any. Now, due to the methodology of the ranked ballot in the leadership race, all ridings are given the same number of points, no matter how many votes are cast in each riding, and each candidate receives a percentage of the same number of points in each riding. Now, O'Toole surprisingly won the majority of Quebec's ridings over Peter McKay, with just a handful of voters in many of the ridings, as Quebec is not where many conservative voters live. Now, Lewis and Sloan were a non-factor in Quebec, as both have poor French skills and are more socially conservative than McKay and O'Toole. But the real reason behind O'Toole's surprising win is that it was only surprising to those who weren't closely following the race, which apparently includes the mainstream media. Now, given the fact that many in the media viewed McKay as the clear front runner solely because of who he is and what his views are, they did not notice the changing dynamics of the campaign. The Globe and Mail even asked in January if McKay was headed for a coronation. And it's quite clear that after the votes were all tallied up that McKay's coronation was doomed to fail. Now, McKay's candidacy was plagued with poor communications and flip-flopping on major issues to Conservative Party voters, from his epilepsy-inducing campaign ads to his flip-flop on the Israeli embassy issue, his distancing of social conservative issues, and most importantly, his attack on former leader Andrew Scheer's personal views after last fall's election, he called a stinking albatross around the neck of the Conservative Party. Now, Scheer was dogged during the campaign by unfair media questions about same-sex marriage and abortion, which were a complete and utter failure of the media to focus on non-issues instead of the very real Trudeau government scandals that are still ongoing to this day. And at the end of the day, it should be noted that same-sex marriage and abortion are closed issues in Canadian politics, and no Conservative Party leader is ever going to bring those up. Now, in the end, McKay only dominated in his native Nova Scotia, winning barely a majority of the points at stake in Prince Edward Island and New Brunswick, and falling short of 50% in Newfoundland and Labrador. Quebec, where he was expected to rack up the points, due to his more centrist views, went to O'Toole by a margin of 11 percentage points on the first ballot. He received much lower results in the Conservative heartland. He placed third in Alberta and fourth in Saskatchewan. Now, the irony of all this is that Peter McKay had become the very thing that he ridiculed in Scheer to propel his leadership bid in the first place, a politician whose campaign was, quote, like having a breakaway on an open net and missing the net, which is what he used to refer to Scheer's election in 2019. It could be said that there is now a fairly conspicuous stinking albatross dangling from Peter McKay's neck. But back to Erin O'Toole. Rather than steal votes from the disastrous Peter McKay campaign, which was only ahead of O'Toole by 2% on the first ballot, with little to no second-choice support from Lewis or Sloan, the media has actually taken a different route. Eric Grenier of the CBC, who, as a poll aggregator, should really be aware by now how voting intentions work, identified social conservative voters as the reason why O'Toole won. Unlike Scheer and Doug Ford, which Grenier points to as moderates needing social conservative votes, however, it was the more moderate Peter McKay whose failures on the first ballot led to O'Toole's obvious choice on the last ballot. Leslyn Lewis's surprising showing also doomed McKay's campaign right from the get-go. Now, the Liberals are already trying to drive the wedge between social conservatives and the rest of the Conservative Party and erode the big tent that Harper and Scheer had built. Liberal MP Pam Damoff of Oakville, North Burlington, demanded that O'Toole remove fourth-place MP Derek Sloan from the party. In her letter, Damoff said that if O'Toole failed to remove Sloan from caucus, it would be akin to condoning statements that Sloan had made throughout the campaign that she called examples of racism, misogyny, and bigotry. Now, Sloan was previously pressured to apologize after asking if Canada's chief medical officer, Dr. Theresa Tam, was working for China, after it was found that she was taking advice from the World Health Organization, which was in turn taking advice from Chinese doctors and the Chinese government. Now, during a press conference on Tuesday, O'Toole was asked about Sloan's controversial comments, and especially those directed at Dr. Tam, but he declined to say whether he would expel the rookie MP from his caucus. O'Toole said that pressures of a leadership race can bring forth a contrast of ideas, but that under his leadership, the Conservative Party will be united. He said, quote, Derek and I had some very stark differences. We had some areas of overlap with our concern about the Communist Party of China. I didn't agree with some of the ways that he characterized some of those concerns, but certainly within a pandemic, within the race we were in, a lot of things were said. We're united now. We're going to talk together as a caucus soon. Now, for his part, Sloan called Damoff's letter a political attack piece. He said, quote, "The timing was such that it was clear that it was a political attack to try and divide the party under its new leadership." Sloan said that the items Damoff published were choice tidbits, chosen out of context, and that he didn't believe she made a concentrated effort to actually go over his leadership campaign in detail. Now, O'Toole quickly swept away the distraction that the liberals tried to foist on the new leader, but the media was there to quickly try and bring up another political non-starter by immediately accosting O'Toole about his social views. Now, O'Toole, for his part, was quick to say that he's not a social conservative and that he has a, what he calls a, quote, track record of always voting in favor of rights, whether it's the rights of women with respect to choice, whether it's the LGBT community. Now, O'Toole was expecting the question, as the media have made it a stupid rite of passage for conservative leaders now. Answering it directly allowed O'Toole to get to his main message, which is that he wants a lot more people to feel that they belong in his party. Racialized minorities, members of the LGBTQ community, Indigenous Canadians, and what he calls more women. Now, after all was said and done, O'Toole got back to his main focus, readying his party for the next election, whenever it may be. O'Toole framed the possibility of a pandemic election being a move that the Liberals may be trying to trigger rather than something that the opposition would force. And he said that, quote, "If Mr. Trudeau thinks he can play some games with a new leader and force an election, we will be ready." Now, while the next election isn't scheduled until 2022, there have been calls for Trudeau to resign amidst the We Charity controversy and threats leveled by the opposition Bloc Québécois and the Conservatives of advancing a motion of non-confidence in the government. Now, as a sitting MP, O'Toole has vowed to hold the Liberals to account on day one, and he says that his focus will be on the well-being of Canadians given the ongoing pandemic rather than an election. Now, the shutdown of Parliament for a month has stopped a series of committee studies into the ongoing We Charity student grant controversy, and O'Toole is imploring Trudeau to allow the committees studying the matter to get back to it in short order in the fall. He says, quote, "I'm here to fight for the well-being of Canadians across the country, and for better solutions, faster responses, and we will assess the government going forward on all those criteria. I will always put the interests of Canadians first, and will collaborate when I can." Now, Navdeep Bains, who is Trudeau's Minister of Innovation, Science, and Industry, doesn't think that O'Toole will be collaborative at all. Along with collaborating with MP Pam Damoff about Sloan, Bains is also in charge of the Huawei file and still hasn't made a definitive decision, one way or another, on Canada's 5G infrastructure. And when asked by reporters about O'Toole, he played boogeyman and warned that an O'Toole government, quote, may muzzle scientists, and that he was worried that Conservatives would revert to what he called, quote, Harper-era anti-science policy under the new leader. And at the end of the day, Navdeep Bains is throwing stones in glass houses. A new Hill Times report shows that Bains was the second highest lobbied minister of the Trudeau government in the month of July. Now, lobbying of the Trudeau government in total for the month of July rose 73% over last year. We have to ask ourselves, is it a coincidence that on August 15th, Navdeep Bains sided with big telecoms companies to tank the idea of cheaper internet in Canada? And I think we all know by now that in politics, there are no coincidences. Last August, the CRTC found that large providers had been overcharging indie ISPs by as much as 77% for wholesale internet access since 2016, and the CRTC then set lower rates accordingly. Many smaller ISPs like TechSavvy and Start.ca immediately passed those savings directly on to customers. Now, those lower prices didn't just benefit their subscribers, it also put downward pressure on home internet plan prices across the country, finally introducing desperately needed price competition to the market. As the Competition Bureau reported at the time, the wholesale access market was fulfilling its promise of increased choice and competition. But now that Bains has put the CRTC's wholesale rates in jeopardy, small providers have had no choice but to start bringing rates back up again. The federal government announced back in August 15th that it thought that the CRT's wholesale internet rates were too cheap and that it might undermine investment from telecom giants. It came as a response to Big Telecom's petition asking the cabinet to overturn the rates, plus over 200 side conversations with their lobbyist. And as predicted, Navdeep Bains' two-faced decision is already making Canada's internet more expensive. And there we go. We see that he's been lobbied successfully and hard, and he's back in the seat of Big Telecom again. So at the end of the day, perhaps the Liberals should be focusing on their own sinking ship with their own scandals rather than demonizing the Conservatives' new leader. And perhaps the media should start asking the right questions to the right people, as instead of talking about what was going on with Pam Damoff and Navdeep Bains, they were instead trying to focus on social conservatives and trying to demonize Erin O'Toole before he even opened his mouth.
And this is something that we saw with Andrew Sheeran. You know, we knew it would be a matter of time before all these different pieces would start appearing in the media this week, and they did like clockwork. And you know that you can see that it's almost a coordinated effort, because the narrative that all of them are peddling is the same thing. And you know, one thing that many people of course have skipped over in this, in the media, is that they neglected to see that in round two, after the voting of ballots transferred, it was Leslyn Lewis who had a substantial number of votes and won every province west of Ontario. You would think that would have been a story this week, but no. You know, they're focused on all the old traditional tricks about how Erin O'Toole won. And, you know, very few points made about Leslyn Lewis. And she's actually confirmed, because of her huge success that she saw in the race, that she will be running in the next election. And that's something that many in the Conservative Party are very happy about.
Yes, exactly. And the fact that Lewis will be running in Calgary in the next election will be quite a strong candidate for the party, and perhaps even a potential cabinet minister in a future Conservative government. But it just goes to show that these tricks that you mentioned, the usual tricks that the media and the Liberals were getting up to, seem to fall a little bit flat. But in the end, it comes down to the media and their coverage of Erin O'Toole as to whether he will be successful or not. And so far, I think he's done quite a good job at speaking and answering questions from the media, especially the biased questions about his social views and ones that don't even matter that much at all. But in the end, it seems like what goes on is whether the media will be actually focusing on the correct things, or if they're just going to do the same things they always have and completely ignore the real issues.
Yeah, and you know, it's very stark when you have fake news floating around and whatnot, and the media peddles that. And you know, in a pandemic, we like to keep things related to the health and the science aspect of it. But of course, policy things like that can always crop in. And dare we head into an election this fall, and the media needs to be on their toes and delivering the whole right side of the story to people out there. And if they don't do that, it falls to smaller independent outlets to do that. And that's why we are here and why we do this podcast each and every week. And if you want to help us do that, you can check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/westerncontext. There we offer three tiers of support. For $2 a month at the price of a cup of coffee, you can help us remove the media bias and sensationalism that we're talking about week after week. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context Insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. When we reach $25 a month in contributions, we'll craft two Patreon-exclusive articles each month, expanding on our show stories from that month. These articles will, of course, continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect. At $50 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month, where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs may be headed next. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. Moving on into Alberta this week. This week was also a jam-packed news week in Alberta. This week we had the fiscal update that showed that the deficit could grow to $24.2 billion, and this was released on Thursday by Finance Minister Travis Tays, where the budget deficit this year when the budget was tabled was initially set to be $7.3 billion, which only happened a week and a bit before the whole COVID pandemic thing started. Now, we'll go over the details of this fiscal update in just a moment here. But first, there was a minor cabinet shuffle this week, if you look at the number of ministers involved, but it was actually very historical for all of Canada. To start off with, Doug Schweitzer was moved from Justice to the new Ministry of Jobs, Economy, and Innovation, taking over from Tanya Fear, with the focus on being the impending economic recovery. Casey Madu, the only Edmonton UCP MLA, who is formerly Municipal Affairs Minister, moves to the Ministry of Justice. Madu's move to the Ministry of Justice comes as the province brings forward criminal justice reforms and reviews the Police Act. Casey Madu also has the distinction of being Canada's first Justice Minister of African descent, and despite all the virtue signaling of the Trudeau camp, Alberta leads the way, not because of quotas or because it's the current year, but because we have very talented ministers. Madu is not only an immigrant from Nigeria, but he was also a practicing lawyer before becoming an MLA. On this, the Premier had to say, "I think it's a powerful statement that Alberta will have the first ever Canadian Justice Minister of African origin, first Black Canadian Justice Minister, Attorney General, or Solicitor General, who is a man who has experienced racial prejudice firsthand and can bring that sensitivity to this important role." And we've often talked about before how important it is to have experienced people in cabinet, whether it be somebody who is a doctor leading a health portfolio during a pandemic, or in this case for Minister Madu, having somebody of African descent leading a police review and looking at racial sensitivity in the wider police forces within the province of Alberta. Now, to just underscore how big this move is, this was actually picked up, this cabinet shuffle was picked up on the BBC, in particular on BBC's Nigerian website, BBC Pigeon. Grand Prairie MLA Tracy Allard takes Madu's place as Municipal Affairs Minister. Quite frankly, this was one of the biggest stories in Alberta this week and could have been a story on its own, but it was displaced by the fiscal update that dropped on Thursday, and it's a little bit unfortunate that we didn't get to ride this news a little bit further, because this is huge news for all of Canada and one that is making waves on the international stage for Casey Madu. But with the budget deficit forecast to hit almost $24.2 billion and the debt to hit almost $100 billion at $99.6 billion to be precise, serious questions about the future of Alberta's finances need to be asked at this point. The discussion, of course, has shifted to whether it's a revenue problem by the NDP and those in the media and some academics. But, of course, we have to go back to the McKinnon panel report and the mandate that Jason Kenney and his government received last year when they were elected. And recall that report that said, on average, per capita, Alberta spends more than any other province. In particular, 20% more to our neighbors to the west in BC. This has to be the area of attack, since administrations going back to Ed Stelmach have continued to spend, and spend some more. The sad revelation was also made by the Premier that this budget will not be balanced in the UCP's first term of government. Many Albertans elected the UCP to balance the budget in their first term at any cost. We'll talk more about that after. Questions of an increase in taxes, canceling the corporate tax cut, or bringing in a PSD have already been asked in the last days by the media since the fiscal update dropped, and the Premier and Finance Minister were clear that taxes would not go up, the corporate tax cut will continue as planned, as a job-creating force, and that the discussion of a PST would be one that could potentially be had later on, after the recovery has been completed. Now, it's important to note here, before anybody jumps in on this, media, NDP, or anybody from any other provinces, in Alberta, it is illegal for a province, or the government, rather, to bring in a provincial sales tax without first holding a referendum and consulting the population. We need to make sure that that's clear so that everybody knows that if the government were to do that, any flavor of government, it would be illegal. And following that, people who are chomping at the bit to have a PST need to know this as well. Now, Drew Barnes, MLA for Cypress Medicine Hat, a former Wild Roser, has called on the government to balance the budget by 2024. The province's COVID-19 response is budgeted to cost about $4.3 billion. This, combined with crude by rail and a drop in income to the tune of resource revenue and taxes mainly, has caused an almost $11 billion drop in our revenue and pushed our budget deficit and debt sky high. Higher than it was, of course. As we have long said here at Western Context, choices need to be made, and now we're about to reap the consequences, as the Premier has called it, a fiscal reckoning. Spending and debt under the former PCs and NDP shook our fiscal framework. An oil collapse brought on by Saudi Arabia and Russia, which at the time when this was happening earlier in the year, many laughed at negative oil prices and assumed they'd stick and would be the end of oil going forward. And if only we could see the smug look on those people's faces right now. The pandemic has also, of course, led us to this point where we're at in terms of talking about the economic shutdown and the increased money that's being spent on infrastructure project. Choices with respect to all three causes were, of course, made. Stelmach, Redford, and Notley could have balanced the budget, but instead spent money. We could have had pipelines, but now we have an expansion to a 50-year-old pipeline going west. Of course, that's the Trans Mountain Pipeline. We have the new Keystone Pipeline going south that's being built. We could have also had Northern Gateway to BC's north coast and Energy East to the east coast through Quebec. This failure to build these pipelines falls squarely on Justin Trudeau and the hostile nature to the resource economy that has been exuded by himself, his ministers, and ultimately his government. As for the pandemic, we also made a choice as a country. Sweden accepted more deaths and more cases, but maintained a functional economy without shutting down. Here, cases are going up and are at what they were while our economy was shut down in part, which begs the question, why did we even shut down? We ultimately won't know until this is over who had the best approach. Us, measured and cautious, the U.S. with the relaxed approach, letting people decide what to do, Europe, a total shutdown, or Sweden, business as usual with physical distancing. But if it's Sweden who's right, there's going to be serious questions that need to be asked about why we did what we did. While the media and the NDP will tell you this is all the UCP's fault, Albertans should ensure that this government quickly balances the budget, brings our spending into line, and ensures that we do not shut down the economy again, ever. That's the lesson of the fiscal update that the media won't tell you about. It's been lost in the literal shuffle of the news this week. And, of course, another thing that was lost was the cabinet shuffle and the promotion of Casey Maddow, marking a significant milestone in Canadian politics.
Yeah, and if you live outside of Alberta, you'd probably be hard-pressed to find out about Casey Maddow becoming the first justice minister in Canada of African descent, and that is quite a big deal at a time with lots of racial tensions in North America, with all that's been going on in the United States and what's spilled over into Canada as well. This is seen as a major move for Alberta, and I think this is something that the media could have talked about quite a bit more and talked about the implications and the historic move of what actually had happened, but instead they decided to focus on something else completely. And while the economy of Alberta is a big deal and what has been going on with the debt is a big deal, it should be noted that the media tends to gloss over how Alberta got into the problems that they did. And a lot of it was at the feet of the federal government of Justin Trudeau, and a lot of it was under the problem of previous provincial governments that did not exercise restraint and prudent fiscal spending. And I think this is a lesson for all governments, is that when times are good, you should not be putting a province into debt, because when times are bad, that's when you need the money to be able to spend. And I think this is something that a lot of governments aren't really taking note of, and certainly the media isn't holding them to account either.
Yeah, and you know, when it comes to the economy, people are always wondering, why do we need to balance the budget? And we saw how quick this COVID situation has escalated from, you know, being something that was mocked in the media in January to starting to pay attention a little bit in February, to the middle of March, the second week of March, completely shutting down the economy, bringing in new spending programs and the like, has, of course, resulted in, you know, utilizing that fiscal cushion, which if the budgets were balanced both here in Alberta and federally, you would have had a different response to that, and many people would have felt differently about those relief programs. But this is why looking forward and maintaining a solid fiscal foundation is very important for provinces, cities, and all governments. And, you know, time and time again, we say that governments are, you know, willing to spend, whereas everybody else who has a credit card has family bills and budgets on their own. They can't overspend like that. They can't go into debt to the tune that the governments do. And the governments owe it to people to keep control of their finances if they expect everybody to continue electing them and keeping their own family fiscal handbooks in order.
Yes, exactly. And I think you could look to BC on that, and that before the pandemic hit, there were balanced budgets going through, and to note that there was even tiny surpluses that could be put into extra problems that the government had arise, whether it was wildfires, whether it was the ICBC meltdown, any problem that could have arisen that was unforeseeable, there was extra money there to actually deal with that. With Alberta's spending, there wasn't extra money. So when the pandemic hit, more debt was accrued. Now, of course, BC has since gone into a little bit of a further debt, but the financial cushion is there. And it's no surprise that people think that Horgan has done a much better job in BC than any other province's premier has done. And I think that's something to note for future governments, is that if you have that financial cushion, if something hits, you're going to be looked upon as a government that is doing what is necessary and doing the right thing. Whereas if you're continually putting your province or country into debt, it's something that's going to be looked upon very unfavorably. And that's something that the federal government should be taking note of as well.
Indeed. Indeed. I think we can move on to BC now. And as per usual, BC stories tend to go against the grain of what we have been talking about here on Western Context, but still very, very important.
Yes, in BC, there is a health crisis sweeping across the province, but it's not one that anyone is talking about. Yes, I'm not referring to the coronavirus pandemic, but a disturbing rise in overdose deaths since the pandemic's effects hit Canada in mid-March. The BC Coroner's Service saw 175 fatalities in July. A statement said that the service had detected a, quote, sustained increase of illicit drug toxicity deaths since the first peak of the pandemic in March, and it's now confirming five straight months with more than 100 such deaths. If you look at the raw numbers from the start of the year to the end of July, 195 people have officially died from COVID-19 in BC. Over that same time frame, 911 people have died in BC from a drug overdose, which is more than 4.5 times as many people. Now, more people are dying of illicit drug overdoses in BC due to homicides, motor vehicle incidents, suicides, and COVID-19 combined. About 5,000 people in BC have died of overdoses since the public health emergency was declared back in 2016. Provincial Health Officer Dr. Bonnie Henry, who has led the response to the province's concurrent health crises of overdoses and coronavirus, said that the pandemic has led to more people using and dying alone. She said, quote, "It's dismaying to know that all of the work that we have done around responding to COVID-19 has been a contributing factor to the number of deaths we've been seeing from the toxic drug supply here in BC and across Canada." Chief Coroner Lisa Lapointe said that the pandemic has restricted access to critical harm reduction services. Still, she urged people to go to supervised injection sites or drug overdose prevention sites to check for substances for toxicity and to not use alone. No deaths have been reported at supervised injection sites or drug overdose prevention sites. Now, this is the first time that we're seeing demographics on the issue, and the results are as shocking as they are predictable. Just under 80% of the people who have died in an overdose in BC this year were men. 85% of the deaths happened indoors. Indigenous people make up 3.4% of the population in BC, but accounted for 16% of all overdoses. Now, fentanyl remains the most significant driver in the high number of deaths across all demographics. Officials have said that border closures during the pandemic have disrupted the usual flow of fentanyl into BC, leading the supply to be replaced by unstable and unpredictable substances produced locally by those who might be inexperienced. Now, just today, it was revealed by the family of well-liked Vancouver Canucks hockey journalist Jason Botchford that his unexpected death at 48 last year was caused by an accidental overdose of fentanyl. It's an example that addiction can grip even those you'd never expect. Dr. Dan Kalla, who is the head of emergency medicine at St. Paul's Hospital in downtown Vancouver, says that, quote, the quality control has never obviously been there with fentanyl, but that it's much worse now when drug traffickers and dealers are throwing the kitchen sink and whatever they have to make the product. Now, sadly, this serious issue is tied with the issue of the homeless, as governments have been largely ineffective at solving this problem as well. Last week, Victoria Mayor's Lisa Helps was just considering banning homeless campers from setting up in the city's core business district, as Victoria bylaws passed while she's been mayor currently allow the homeless to shelter in certain parks under several restrictions. Now, there are four homeless encampments in the city of Victoria, the largest being Beacon Hill Park, right downtown. The others three are at Centennial Square, which is right near City Hall, Crystal Pool, which is to the east, and Cecilia Ravine Park, which is further to the north. Now, the camps have meant that public perception of the downtown core has taken a hit. Victoria Police reported a surge in property crime in the first 7 months of the year, with break and enters nearly doubling. Weapons and bylaw calls were also up by 50%. Shoplifting and theft calls were down, but downtown Victoria Business Association Executive Director Jeff Bray says that he believes those numbers are underreported by merchants who see no value in calling police when the issue won't be resolved. Bray believes that the property crime surge is related to growing homeless encampments, including one right outside City Hall in Centennial Square. Now, Victoria Police say that their resources are already stretched thinly, in part because of several growing homeless camps in the area. Officers will prioritize life safety incidents, meaning that property crime calls often fall to the bottom of the list. Constable Cam McIntyre says, quote, a lot of our resources right now are deployed to the Burnside Gorge area and Beacon Hill Park. Now, the Burnside Gorge area is where many hotels were bought by the BC government to house homeless people, which we've talked about on previous editions of Western Context. McIntyre also reports that police, quote, have seen an increase in property crime, violent crime, public disturbances, social disorder issues in both of those areas. Now, Victoria Police also went undercover into the Centennial Square homeless camp beginning on August 11th, following an increase in crime, what they call linked to the drug trade in the area. Now, just one day before the investigation was launched, two stabbings took place in Centennial Square, and before that, multiple assaults were seen in the square, and a window at City Hall was shot and broken by a compressed air gun that was fired from the encampment. Now, undercover officers were able to buy methamphetamine, cocaine, psilocybin, and fentanyl from tents in the square. Police say that they found that multiple tents were being used on a rotating basis to sell drugs. A tent would be emptied of bedding to use for drug deals one day, then bedding would be returned to the tent and someone would sleep there the next day. The following day, the bedding would be removed and the same tent would revert to being used for drug trafficking again. Undercover officers were even robbed and faced violence when posing as customers. And at the end of the investigation, 5 of the 17 suspects have been arrested for drug trafficking, with warrants out on the remaining 12. Now, Vic PD also issued a public alert after a city worker found an uncapped hypodermic needle taped to a park bench beside City Hall last Tuesday. Police say that the needle was reportedly placed in such a way that someone who sat on the bench would have been harmed. Just one day before that, a teenage boy was pricked by an uncapped needle that was hidden in the grass at a park in Saanich. Earlier in the month, a used uncapped needle was found secured to a railing on a heavily used path in the Beacon Hill Park downtown Victoria, near where another homeless camp is. And yet another example, last Friday, Vic PD received reports of a man shouting and behaving in an unusual manner near a downtown playground near where kids were playing. The individual had left by the time police arrived, but while the patrol officers searched the area, they came across six large knives and a hypodermic needle with no cap, and they were found just 30 feet from the playground where dozens of children were playing. Now, a few weeks ago, a well-known landscaper in Victoria actually canceled a multi-thousand-dollar lucrative contract with a downtown business in the Store Street neighborhood to the west of downtown after she was pricked by a used needle while at work. Kim Hall, who owns Miss Green Thumbs Landscaping in Victoria, says that while working, she found 19 needles in 3 days on the property that she was re-landscaping. She is now refusing to ever take another contract in Victoria's downtown core. Now, at the end of the day, Victoria City Council's tolerance for the homeless camps and enablement and promise of free shelter and aid has also led to homeless people moving into the city from all across Canada, from as far away as the Maritimes, according to Victoria Police Chief Del Manick. Media reports have been saying for years that people moving to Victoria for community support is untrue, but Manick says that his officers regularly hear stories of newcomers looking for help in the city, and he said, quote, many of them are coming from as far away as Nova Scotia. Now, according to the most recent homeless count in Victoria, which took place on March 11th, very shortly before everything shut down, 88% of homeless in the city reported living in the region for at least 1 year or longer. Manick maintains that Victoria appears to be a destination for those looking for aid. He said, quote, people definitely are here from out of town, out of province, looking for a free place to stay. He said he detailed one report where he said, quote, we just talked to a couple who used their CERB money to drive their vehicle from Ontario, came out with their dog, and they're now staying in a motel. Their whole sole purpose of coming to Victoria was because they need a place to live, and that they heard that if they come to Victoria, they'd be offered that opportunity. Manick says that similar stories are coming from people who migrate to Victoria from northern BC, northern Vancouver, up island, or even out of the province. Now, with all this in mind, it's clear that the opioid epidemic is a real crisis that needs to be addressed by all levels of government. And while I used many local examples, it doesn't just affect British Columbians or even all Canadians. It affects all of North America. The fact that the national media has completely ignored this serious issue in favor of daily COVID-19 counters is despicable. And it's clear that the media does not have our best interests at heart.
And, you know, there's always going to be the talk about what would happen with an economic shutdown like we saw start in March with the pandemic. And, you know, it's only obvious and, you know, people theorize that you'd see these kind of factors like drug overdoses and whatnot go up with that. And they certainly did, as we're seeing here. And, you know, it really speaks to a breakdown in terms of what the municipal leaders jobs are. And, you know, we talk about, of course, we've talked many times before here about the Victoria City Council and what they're up to, you know, removing John A. McDonald statues. That's what they're interested in. But on the other hand, putting out the welcome mat saying they're open for business brings these people out. It's going to, as we saw, increase drug overdoses, and that's never good. China is a major source of this fentanyl, killing many, many people out there. And there's also one other factor that we need to talk about with this. You mentioned the names of many of these parks. Many of these parks are renowned across Canada as places people can come and see when they visit Victoria. But on the other hand, with them being turned into homeless encampments, what does that leave for people who want to come and visit Victoria's, what used to be in this case, pristine parks on this case, to walk in the park? And, you know, we've seen many cases, as was highlighted in these stories, of people just walking along in the grass and getting pricked. And that's not something that you want to hear about. And quite honestly, there needs to be someone at some level, whether it's the Victoria City Council level or at the provincial government level, who's going to say no and realize that this can't go on forever and something needs to change before it gets any worse than it is now.
Yeah, it's quite clear that the municipal council is over their heads on this issue, given the fact that they're only just considering taking issue with this. And this has been going on for months now, since the start of the pandemic. The opioid crisis has been going on for years now, and yet no governments have truly tried to tackle the problem. And it seems like the federal government has been not, they've been completely absent on the issue. The BC government has tried to put some resources towards it, but they haven't really been focusing on it very heavily, and a lot of it's been more talk. And the municipal government has done what they think is the compassionate route, but really it's just been attracting more people and from all over Canada, and using the federal government's money that people get from CERB. They've been coming out here as almost as a vacation when people are discouraged from traveling, doing dirt due to the pandemic. So it's almost like the government solutions that they've been coming up with have been actually providing the opposite from a solution, and they've just been exacerbating the problem. And while this has been going on, there has to be a look on what's going to happen with the tourist industry. And everyone knows the Victoria has long been a beautiful place to visit for tourists. But with this going on, with the pandemic, with a lot of tourist industry looking to rebound after the pandemic has ravaged a lot of that industry, this is also another real thing that's going to be discouraging a lot of people from wanting to visit Victoria. And I think that there's been a lot of problems with that in Vancouver as well. And this is something that BC government needs to really look at, and that the federal government should be looking at as well.
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, if there is that fall election, the parties out there should present a plan for dealing with this, a plan for dealing with the opioid epidemic, wherever it comes from, also dealing with these homeless issues that are degrading these once nice parks and providing a way to, if I don't want to say bail out, but just a way to effectively rescue these city governments who are in over their head, as you said. But, you know, many of the cases of fentanyl that come into Canada previously were coming in through China, and fentanyl China is definitely something that's an issue, but China is still a big issue, and this is our firing line this week. This is a story that took us by surprise here, and, you know, to start with this one, we're going to be talking about Nortel, a famous Canadian company that was founded in the late 19th century, previously known as Northern Electric, before they became involved in modern telecommunications. And they were one of Canada's telecom giants until 2009, when they filed for bankruptcy protection. It was widely assumed at the time that Nortel went under because they weren't able to compete with the likes of Apple or Google or even Canada's own BlackBerry manufacturer Research in Motion. But this week, a new report in Global News rewrites that history to be much more nefarious. Put simply, the Chinese Communist Party was responsible for the downfall of one of Canada's largest homegrown companies. To understand what happened with this, we have to go back to 2004 when Nortel discovered a serious breach in their Nortel network. At that time, 70% of all internet traffic ran on Nortel's technology, and when you think about it, that means Canadian technology, and you can probably see where we're going with this one on that front. The breach wasn't child's play or script kiddies work, as it's called. It was a far more sophisticated attack aimed at stealing Nortel's corporate secrets. The attacks were found to have originated from Shanghai, and a server was hacked where upwards of 1,448 documents were downloaded and stolen. Those doing the hacking also managed to control the accounts of 7 Nortel executives. It's said that Nortel's executives were more concerned with balance sheets and yearly profits compared to whether or not data had been stolen. And the hacking continued from 2004 until 2009, and also in 2009, after being underbid on a series of contracts by Huawei, Nortel declared bankruptcy. And you can see here, that's precisely the angle that this story was going on. Where did Huawei come from? And what was their rise having to deal with Nortel's story? Security advisor Brian Shields, who investigated the attack, said that by the time it was over, the Chinese Communist Party had gained complete control over Nortel's internal systems. In describing the attack, S.H.I.E.L.D. said that the infiltration was so insidious that technicians in China could send encrypted packages of stolen Nortel data to Shanghai and Beijing by sending internet commands to a backdoor buried in a Nortel computer. Now, to visualize this in the real world, it would be similar to a foreign army constructing a hidden tunnel into Canada's treasury vault and marching out with unimpeded amounts of gold bars. Shields also believes that it's more than coincidence that Huawei replaced Nortel as the world's dominant internet technology provider. Now, Global News on the story is seeking Canadian military intelligence records that will back up what Shields has said, but they're currently in a delayed vetting disclosure process to make sure there's no major confidential information that will be disseminated with that. Now, a Canadian intelligence expert who Global agreed not to name, who has knowledge of the Nortel investigation, says that at the time this was going on, the federal government would have known exactly what was happening with the Nortel case. The evidence that China compromised Nortel is indisputable, the expert said. It was being systemically compromised and everything was being taken. The only question is to what extent this caused Nortel to fall. There was actionable evidence, but the executives at Nortel saw it as an exaggerated claim that looked like something out of a spy novel. They basically believed that it couldn't have been happening. The expert claims to Global News that the Canadian intelligence eventually made the stunning discovery that the Chinese Communist Party was using Chinese organized crime gangsters in attacks on Nortel. Now, this is still happening today, but on something that touches every single Canadian. In July, it was announced that the FBI accused Chinese intelligence services and organized crime groups of colluding in cyber attacks targeting COVID-19 vaccine research in Canada and other intellectual property in many nations, and also Chinese dissidents in Canada, which we've talked about before on the podcast. Also, while this was happening, the Chinese government made the decision to not ship vaccine samples to Canada when Canada and China had previously agreed to work on a vaccine candidate together. The vaccine was supposed to begin human trials in May, but that has been delayed since the samples were not shipped to Canada. The reason for this? Chinese customs never approved that the samples be shipped out from China. In the end, the Canadian Centre for Vaccinology wasn't able to participate in the study because based on the time that's gone by, the study has become less and less relevant. The vaccine candidate known as 85-nCoV is showing promising results in China. Meng Wanzhou, the Huawei CFO being held in Vancouver this week, also lost an appeal to have CSIS reveal more information about her arrest, and Canada's Attorney General said that the details in these documents should be shielded from public view under the provisions of the Canada Evidence Act dealing with national security and international relations. Meng and her Huawei legal team wanted these details released. The judge said that they do not amount to missing pieces of the puzzle. Meng Wanzhou and Huawei believe that her arrest is a conspiracy between Canada and the United States. It seems that Nortel was ultimately taken down by the Chinese government. The Chinese, of course, in the past wanted to buy a majority stake in Saskatchewan's potash company, but this was shot down by the previous conservative government. China has deep influence in retirement homes on the Lower Mainland and BC that we've talked about. China is also, of course, responsible for most of the fentanyl that comes into Canada and the US, which is killing our citizens. Then finally, the cherry on top of the cake is the COVID-19 pandemic that has crippled the world, and China is yet seeking again to benefit from that. People may deny it or laugh about this, but China is as much our enemy now as the USSR was during the Cold War. We need to take a proactive stance against China and perhaps going even as so far to boycott Chinese companies, divesting our manufacturing and research from China, and sanctioning them for their actions when it comes to their shady policies on trade, currency manipulation, industrial espionage, and not being frank with the rest of the world when it came to the new coronavirus. Canada, of course, can't act alone on this, but we need help from the United States and our G7 partners. We could make a dent if it was a concerted effort amongst the G7. Who knows, though? Maybe CSIS and the CIA need to team up for some industrial espionage against China to take down Huawei, or maybe even get back at them for their actions that they took on this vaccine candidate that we were supposed to work on together.
Yes, it's been quite clear for quite some time that China is going to be no friend to Canada and hasn't been for quite some time when it comes to industrial espionage, the rise of Huawei, and now Huawei is wanting to infiltrate the Canadian infrastructure once again. They're trying to buy mines up north. They're trying to assert dominance over the Northwest Passage. They're trying to buy other corporations in Canada. They're trying to buy into the healthcare industry in Canada. It's all an insidious takeover that they've been trying and succeeding in many other countries around the world in the Asian sphere of influence and in Africa. And this is something that's been going on for years, and yet the government has not been taking action on this. And this is something that I was actually looking at Aaron O'Toole, the new conservative leader, for, because he's always had a very strong stance on China, and even when becoming leader, he didn't back away from it. And he said that he was very concerned about the Communist Party of China. Not often do you hear a party leader in Canada talking about the actual Communist Party of China. Normally, they all mention China's government or China or Beijing, but they don't actually mention the Communist Party of China. And I think that's something that's very notable out of the new Conservative Party of Canada leader. And certainly this is something that's been going on. And it's just time after time, we see week after week, these new stories that come about China trying to infiltrate into Canada and undermine our democracy. And I think this week we had three examples of that.
Yeah, and there are very few people on the world stage who get China and the way they operate. You know, we had the story about how the Chinese Communist Party is lobbying federal government officials. We don't know how deep that influence permeates either. It's everywhere. But there's very few leaders out there who understand the way that China operates. And the way China operates is they don't think on the year or the decade plan or maybe the five-year plan like some governments do. They think out at a very large scale. 100 years plus. They think in the terms of dynasties. And if we're not careful, we're going to look back at the end of the 21st century and we're going to see that the 21st century was marked by what China did and their ever increasing rise into the world. And that's fine. But when they're doing it through nefarious methods such as industrial espionage and undermining national companies, that's not okay. And that definitely needs to be dealt with. And honestly, we're going to need to be heading forward on a path that's going to be looking at this and dealing with this as it goes forward. And this takes us nicely into our word of the week.
Yes, and our word of the week is reckoning, which is defined as the avenging or punishing of past mistakes or misdeeds. And you could use this in many different ways. You could say that there's going to be a reckoning on China with the coronavirus pandemic, or for all the other things that they've done in acting against Canada and Canadians. We could also say there's a reckoning for Trudeau with all of his scandals that have happened, and that the new conservative leader, Aaron O'Toole, is going to be a part of that reckoning. But certainly a reckoning is coming, and it seems like 2020, as we move into the last quarter of the year, there's going to be quite a reckoning coming for a lot of things that are happening in Canada.
Perfect word of the week. Also, of course, touches into the firing line and what needs to happen with China as well. And one day it's going to surprise everybody, and that will be a reckoning. So that is a pretty good word of the week for this week. But this wraps this episode of Western Context. If you want full show notes, you can find those in our website at westerncontext.ca. We got supplementals to everything that we talked about this week. Many supplementals for a lot of the stories this week at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on a number of podcast listeners out there, Apple, Google, Pocket Cast, which is banned in China, Stitcher, and many others. Just visit Western westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook, where you can find our shows and stories that we're looking at throughout the entire week at Western Context. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll be able to look through all the stories that the mainstream media talks about and a lot that they aren't talking about it, and certainly the angles that they aren't covering, whether it is on China, whether it's on Aaron O'Toole, or any other story that's going on, whether it's in radio, print, TV, online, you name it, we will find it, and we will give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context.